From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Do you still stand by the pledge to support whoever the nominee, even if it's Donald Trump?
Well, Anderson, as you mentioned, what I said is true. I'm not in the habit of supporting someone who attacks my wife and attacks my family. I think that is going beyond the line.
That was Republican presidential candidate Texas Senator Ted Cruz responding to a question from CNN's Anderson Cooper at Tuesday's Republican debate, asking if he would support Republican opponent Donald Trump should Trump win the Republican nomination. Trump expressed an even stronger denial of support for Cruz.
It sounded, when I was pressing Senator Cruz on it, sounded like he was saying he'd have a hard time supporting somebody who went after his
wife. Honestly, he doesn't have to support me. I'm not asking for support.
I want the people's support. Do you continue to pledge whoever the Republican nominee is?
No, I don't anymore. Look,
you don't?
No, we'll see who it is.
You won't promise to support the Republican nominee?
And he was essentially saying the same thing. Let me just tell you, he doesn't have to support me. I have tremendous support right now from the people.
Boy, the idea of supporting whoever the Republican nominee is, you say you will no longer guarantee that you will support the Republican nominee.
I have been treated very unfairly. Look, I won the state of Missouri, right? No, I have. Cruz people. I've been treated very unfairly. I'll give you an example.
Unfairly by who?
I think by basically the RNC, the Republican Party, the establishment.
Well, Democrat Bernie Sanders has laid out his idea of what Democratic Party opponent Hillary Clinton needs to do to gain his support. His party likewise faces a similar crisis. Earlier this month, a Wall Street Journal NBC News poll found that one-third of Sanders supporters do not see themselves voting for Clinton in November. Should Clinton secure the nomination in a way that leaves Sanders supporters with a sense that it was stolen from their candidate, that percentage could grow substantially. While both of the two so-called major parties face a crisis of legitimacy that has them teetering on the edge of collapse, the voices of those presenting alternatives to the policies that have brought this about are still being locked out. In one example, this past Monday, Dr. Margaret Flowers, the Green Party's candidate for the U.S. Senate from Maryland, walked on stage at a candidates' forum at Goether College as the Republican candidates were leaving the stage and the Democratic candidates were being announced. She asked for an opportunity to speak and was physically forced off the stage. Some audience members walked onto the stage after Flowers was taken off. They were forced off as well. The demands from the crowd in support of her continued until moderators and security had to settle the crowd down. Dr. Flowers is a Maryland pediatrician and mother of three, a 1990 graduate of the University of Maryland School of Medicine. She completed her pediatric residence at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, and in 2007 left her private practice to advocate full-time for state and federal single-payer health care. We spoke with her via Skype from Baltimore Wednesday. It was an interesting little event. Almost everyone in the room wanted you to speak, and they hurried you out of there like they were afraid you might say something.
Yeah. You know, that was actually really amazing and unexpected. I didn't even know about that because I was pushed out so quickly that I had no idea what happened after I left. But, you know, it's interesting because I was so pleased when I got the first invitation to the candidate forum that they were treating me equally with the other candidates. And then it was really a surprise when just, you know, 2 weeks before the forum, they disinvited me from the event.
What was the reasoning behind that? What did they say? And how did they explain the original invitation in the first place against it?
Well, they started saying we had too many people who responded. And I said, well, that still doesn't, you know, remove you from your obligation to treat all candidates equally. And they said, well, we're only picking people who polled a 5% or better. We've always done that. It's always been our rule. Of course, that was not in the original correspondence. They had actually invited me twice because they had to change the date. And then when that backfired, it was, oh, well, you're not in a primary. I said, yes, I'm in a primary. And they said, well, you're not in a contested primary. You know, the point is, for me in Maryland, in this state, because we're such a solidly blue state, voters literally don't think of the general election as the election. Once the primaries are over, really there's very little attention to the races until, you know, right around Election Day. And so this is the time when I have to be included in the forums and the debates in order to reach people and to distinguish myself from the other candidates. And I'm really being shut out of that process.
You know, I mean, that's a condition that prevails across the country. You know, with this Senate seats, it's one thing because they're statewide, but wherever you have assembly districts or other, you know, congressional districts where, you know, they're essentially gerrymandered, you have the same condition that prevails. In fact, it's created with the creation of the district.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we call this a mirage democracy for a good reason. It's really, you know, designed by those who are in power to keep the people that they want to have, you know, in power. And it what's been really great, you know, the support that night was really, you know, wonderful for me to see. But also, when I do get a chance to talk to people, I did speak at a forum about a month ago, and it was interesting. The two Democratic candidates are really maneuvering so that they're never on a stage with me. One of them showed up and said he only had 20 minutes to stay, so they let him go and he left. And then the other one didn't arrive until over an hour later. So I had a large chunk of time with the community, and they wanted to ask me a lot of questions. And afterwards, they were just super supportive of my campaign because I can be frank with them. You know, I just tell the truth, and we talk about solutions that you don't hear from any of the other candidates.
You know, one of the things that's really striking to me is the, and I think to almost everyone that's paying attention, is the amount of disaffection that is, it's almost universal across the Republican and Democratic parties. We're seeing it, you know, exhibited in the primary process. Sanders on the one hand, Trump on the other. Huge antipathy from the grassroots towards the party structures. It seems that there would be tremendous opportunities this year for third-party candidates. Do you think they're doubling down this year? I mean, it's been a, you know, pretty ugly scene forever, but do you think they're doubling down because they see there's such fertile ground for your campaign?
Yeah, that's a good point. I actually saw this real opening because in our last election in Maryland for governor, we actually elected a nobody Republican because the Democrats didn't turn out. They were not inspired by the candidate, and they probably just assumed that he would win anyway. So I thought, wow, there's a, like just like you said, a lot of people are not inspired by candidates and not turning up to support them. So I think that that could really be the case because my partner, Kevin Zeese, who ran for U.S. Senate in Maryland 10 years ago, was invited to a lot of forums and debates in the primary. And they're really fighting me every step of the way to keep me out of them and to keep the other Greens in Maryland out as well. We've been, you know, really having to push for everyone to be included.
What positions would you have laid out at this debate and are you laying out in your campaign that distinguish it from, say, from either of the Democratic candidates?
Well, some of the main things I'm, you know, talking about, of course, single-payer health care, because that's how I got into this type of activism. And we still need to push for that. The other candidates keep talking about how wonderful the ACA is and how they helped to pass it. I think the climate crisis is really critical, and I'm talking about no new fossil fuel or nuclear infrastructure, you know, doing a comprehensive, immediate transition to a clean energy economy, a just transition for workers. They're talking about cap and dividend at the most. That's the most progressive position. Talking about our foreign policy, you know, we need to, of course, respect human rights and international law, stop providing aid and weapons to Israel and Saudi Arabia, start to respect the sovereignty of other countries, disarm our nuclear weapons. No one else is talking about that. Talking about ways that we can reduce the wealth divide through institutions like public banks that can be used to create infrastructure here in Baltimore. Our water system is in really bad shape. Our sewer system is in bad shape. Things like creating, you know, finding funds for building a clean transit manufacturing facility. Nobody in the United States is manufacturing clean transit. And we have a whole area in Baltimore that was devastated by NAFTA, our steel industry. And we still have this, you know, land that could be used for a manufacturing hub. So, you know, things like that, you know, different types of community wealth building instead of extractive economic models, things that really lift up people within their communities and create wealth that stays in that community. So these are just all ideas that that the others aren't talking about. Oh, and one more is, you know, a universal basic income, which was a very mainstream idea in the 1970s. And no one else is talking about it right now, but other places around the world are starting to put a universal income into place.
And where can people go to get a, you know, better, a bigger picture of what your campaign is about?
Well, my website is www.flowersforsenate.org. It's flowers, F-O-R, senate.org. And we're calling this a solutions campaign because we're really focusing on solutions to the crises that we face. And so if you click on the top bar where it says solutions, you'll see some information about my platform. And we're going to be putting more out right around the time of the end of the primary, assuming if I get the nomination. We'll put out a full platform right after that.
Dr. Margaret Flowers, Green Party candidate for U.S. Senate from Maryland. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Kevin Zeese is co-director of Popular Resistance, which grew out of the Occupy movement. He's an attorney and advocate on a wide range of issues, including ending the war on drugs, economic justice, climate change, and more, and is a nationally known and well-respected expert on voting rights and ballot access issues. We spoke with him via Skype from Baltimore Wednesday. Margaret Flowers, Green Party Senate candidate for Maryland, gets ejected from a debate Monday night. There's some discussion about the fact that this was for primary election candidates only and that she's not going to be on the ballot for the primaries, and so she wasn't eligible after she was invited. This kind of shenanigans are going on around the country, of course, as is this problem of getting on the ballot in general. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, let's talk about this case with Margaret for a little bit.
Sure.
If you get a chance to see the video, the raw video or the real news video, you'll see that the audience, even though it was a partisan audience, because they were not expecting a Green, most of them were not expecting a Green to be there, was very much with her. They really wanted her to have a chance to debate. People are sick and tired of these rigged elections with closed debates where only some candidates are heard. So I think the people recognize our democracy is in crisis, and that's a key first step. The second thing about that, as you mentioned in your introduction, they said this was for primary candidates only. Well, the fact is, Margaret has a primary. It's just not a government-funded and government-run primary, so she won't be on the government ballot, but the Green Party in Maryland does have a primary system that they have to run. And so for a month, for the month of March, we will be having mail-in ballots, and then on April 1st, did I get that wrong? Month of April, we'll be having a write-in ballot, and on May 1st, we'll be having a live voting day. People can come in and vote in person, and that will finish off the primary process for the Greens. And we have contested elections. In fact, the Green Party believes in democracy so much that no one gets a free ride. If you're not having a challenger, you still have to deal with none of the above, because we don't want anyone coming onto our ballot, and we want to make sure our candidates are qualified. And so we have a primary system. And so that excuse was false. The other excuse they gave was it was too many people responding. If you look at the stage, you'll see there are two seats. That's not really a very crowded stage.
Right.
It was just Edwards and Van Hollen. And then they claimed that I had to have 5% in the polls. I have lots of problems with the idea of corporate media polls deciding who gets to debate, but the reality is, of course, they don't poll Greens, and so there are no polls. And when they do general polls, they don't even include Greens, and so you have no idea what the support is. There's no question Mark would have well over 50% support in the Green Party poll, because she's a recognized national advocate who has worked on key issues. Single-payer health care was one of the first she became nationally known for.
Right.
She's been on Bill Moyer's journal twice talking about that and other issues.
Yeah.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership, she's been leading a five-year campaign to stop it. She's been involved in the We Are Cove Point effort to stop the Dominion exit terminal for frac gas now for about 2 years. So on issue after issue, she's nationally known. And so she would get high popularity among Green candidates, Green voters. So this is just one way. And it's interesting how this primary issue is so important. You know, you don't think of it very often, but it's one way they really stop us from being in the electoral discussion. The Baltimore Sun, for example, John Fritzy, who's their political editor, covering the Senate, says he will not cover Margaret until after the primary. Well, what do you mean? Give the Democrats like a 6 month lead of free, no challenges from a party against them? So they get 6 months of free publicity. Then what really happens after the primary? Then John Fritz will say, "Well, it's really over now. There's really not really any competition anymore."
Right. That's right.
And so it's a totally. It just shows how the corporate media and the corporate parties work together to keep us out. So you know, I could go through the whole list of various problems that we have with the electoral system, and it starts really from the existence of the party. They create these incredible hurdles to even allow the party to exist. Just this last week, there was a decision in Georgia where the ballot access rules were thrown out.
That's right.
You had to collect 50,000 signatures. That usually means you need to collect 100,000 signatures because they throw so many signatures out. 100,000 signatures, and the judge said that was unfair. He knocked it down to 7,000 signatures. That's how unfair it was.
Right.
And in Baltimore, in Maryland, we have a problem in that you have to collect 10,000 signatures every 4 years, which means collecting 17,000 or 18,000. And the Board of Elections now has said that if a voter whose name is John Doe signs his petition John James Doe or John J. Doe, that's not the same person. We can't count that as a valid signature. They give a different address because they've moved. That can't be a valid signature. So they've created incredible hurdles just in the process of getting onto the ballot. And then we have Maryland closed primaries. And so when you have a state which is overwhelmingly Democrat, there's twice as many Democrats as the Republicans, and the Republicans have twice as many registered voters as all the others combined. So it's a very dominantly Democrat state, about as blue as you can get. So if you really want to have any role in deciding the future, you want to vote in the primary because that's where most of the elections take place. After the primary, the media stops covering it and everyone just assumes a Democrat will win. And so the closed primary keeps people from joining the Green Party because they want to be part of the process. And then, of course, the debates. And the debates are a problem everywhere. And what that really shows is the connection between the corporate parties and the nonprofit industrial complex. You know, these liberal groups that align with the Democratic Party will do what the Democratic Party wants and have just a Democrat-only debate. And so they will keep us out in cahoots with the corporate Democratic Party. So debates are a problem. But at the national level, that's an even bigger problem because there you have a much more fraudulent approach. You have this phony national commission, they call it, on presidential debates. It's really a national corporation on presidential debates, and the corporation was founded by Democrats and Republicans in order to keep third parties out, and it's funded by big business interests. And they have been very successful since the era of Ross Perot. They were founded after that. They've been very successful at keeping third parties out because they have rigged the whole debate process. And if you don't get in the debates in the presidential election, that's really the only time that 50 million to 70 million people are going to be watching the presidential campaign with any seriousness, you really have no chance to make any progress. So that hurdle is a massive one. And then there are all sorts of other problems in our so-called democratic system. We really have what you have to call managed elections, and it's really kind of a mirage democracy. You know, our Constitution was written in the 1700s, and since that time there's been a lot of advances in how elections work and how a democracy operates. Advances that ensure greater democracy. Things like proportional representation, where if a political party gets 5%, each country can pick whatever percent they want, but we'll use the number 5% of the vote, they would get 5% of the representatives in the legislature. And that way, different views are heard throughout the legislative time period. It's not just who wins that election with 50.1% and the losers are 49.9%. That 50.1% gets representation for the existence of the legislative time period. Everybody else is ignored. So proportional representation is one example of how we could greatly improve our democracy and allow greater participation of multiple parties. And, you know, the United States basically has the most firmly implanted two-party system in the world. And that's not a compliment. That's actually a criticism. And we prevent people from having elections where they where majority support is required for somebody to win. And you do that by having some kind of a runoff voting system. One form is an instant runoff voting. Another form is to have a second election with the top two candidates. I kind of prefer the second approach, but people for money reasons prefer this, the first approach of instant runoff voting. And that would allow people to rank their choices. And if there is no one getting a majority in the first count, then the bottom candidate, his or her votes, get second votes, go to that second vote. And until you get a majority, you keep doing that. So that's a way to ensure majority support. And so we have a lot of catching up to do in the United States. One thing that I'm glad to see beginning to happen, which is a critical step, is that the government is responsible for registering voters. Rather than putting up hurdles for voters to register, you have a system where everyone is registered once they turn of age to be a registered voter, and that you're assumed to be registered voters. You come in to a voting area with your driver's license to show that you actually are 18 years old, that you live in the area, then you can be registered. But you shouldn't even have to show your driver's license. That should be resolved before you get to the booth. The United States, we do the opposite. We create hurdles to get in, then we cleanse the list. If someone doesn't vote for two or three elections in a row, they're erased from the list. That's a mistake. People are not voting for a good reason. Voting is rigged in this country. They know it almost always makes no difference. You have two parties that are funded by Wall Street, and those are the only two parties that can win. So in these rigged elections that are so carefully managed, people say, why vote? And so we have a lot of work to do to create a real democracy in this country. And Margaret, the other day, as you can see in that video, was standing up for democracy. She was risking arrest. Happily, she was just removed and not arrested. She was risking arrest for democracy. And that's the kind of revolt we need to have in order to change this political system.
You know, what was really striking to me was the amount of support for her that was exhibited among the people that were in attendance, who presumably were there to hear the debate between the two Democratic candidates, which was what was advertised.
Exactly. Yeah, I was shocked by that, too. You know, when I after Margaret was taken out, one of our colleagues, Shay, went up and sat in an African-American Black Lives Matter activist, sat in the one of the chairs of Van Hollen Edwards. I saw him up there, and I decided to go up and join him. And when I went up there and looked out at the audience, I saw exactly what you saw. Amazing amount of support for Margaret being in the debate. I saw a few partisans who were like angrily shouting, you're not supposed to be in this debate, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But I saw the vast majority.
Huge.
Huge on our side, saying, let her debate, bring her back on stage. It was really kind of felt good to see that kind of concern for democracy that's really there. You know, and you can see it in the elections with Trump and Sanders. People are rejecting the status quo. They want something different. And, you know, I wish Sanders had run as an independent because I think this is an incredibly opportune year for it. We have, for the first time ever, 50% of the American public saying they are not aligned with either party. They consider themselves independents. Under 30% of Americans saying they're either Republican or Democrat. And so the vast majority now is independents. But, of course, when you look at the Federal Elections Commission, it's always a tie between Republicans and Democrats because that's the only people they allow as commissioners are Republicans and Democrats. No independents are allowed even. So even when it gets to the regulatory process, you see the corporate duopoly dominating how elections are run.
Well, that's done at the state level as well, of course. Here in New York,
exactly.
For example, you have two election commissioners in each county, and one is the way the statute reads, the two top vote getters in the gubernatorial election. But in right. fact, what you have is a Republican and a Democrat, and each has a deputy commissioner. All of the decisions about which signatures are good or not, who's on the ballot or not, are determined by them. And so, and obviously, a third party candidate is has no friends in that process.
And then, of course, we have the problem we haven't mentioned, which is one of the biggest, which is the money. The funding of elections is done by a very small percentage of ultra wealthy people. There's not really, very few states have decent mechanisms for clean elections where if you collect enough signatures, raise enough money, that you get a matching fund. In some places, more than just a dollar for dollar matching fund. And that's what we really need at the national level and the local level is a clean election system where every candidate is able to, if they raise enough money or get enough signatures, are able to get enough money to at least get their message out. You know, we don't expect in this democracy, so-called democracy, to ever see really a fair election system where everyone has equal amounts of money, equal amounts of airtime. That would be the optimum. But we're not that kind of country. We're not really into equality in that way. But at least to have a candidate having enough money to be able to get their message out, that would make a gigantic difference in what kind of elections we had.
You know, Dr. Flowers is a perfect example of this. You mentioned three different areas where she's been a national, even international activist known in terms of single payer, in terms of the TPP, and in terms of the XT pipeline. Those are issues, each one of them, where the majority certainly of enrolled Democrats are strongly on the same page that she's on, and the leadership not. And she got involved at the beginning and so far has prevailed on two out of three of those as one of the early activists. So she would be a formidable candidate if she were allowed to speak to the issues.
Exactly. And I was just a partialist. I could have made a look. We've also done economic democracy conferences nationally to create a new economy that, you know, deals with the inequality and the wealth divide and creates really wealth-creating jobs for people. And renews communities. And we've done that both nationally and locally in Baltimore. So Mark has been a leader on the new economy. I could go on a long list, but I think you're exactly right. She would be a very formidable candidate if people were allowed to know what she has done, what her qualifications are, and what her vision is. Because there are so many issues that will not be discussed in this campaign. And you're right, the issues that Mark has worked on have supermajority support, 60% and higher. In the single-payer issue, 80% of Democrats support single-payer, expanded and improved Medicare for all. And so she's on the right side of what political people want, but the system ensures they don't get to know that. They only get to know they have two pablum Democrats running in the primary that we can predict exactly what they're going to say before they say it, because they're only allowed to say within a small frame of reference. They're only allowed to say minimal things because the Wall Street Democratic Party controls what they can do and what they can say. Having Margaret in the Senate, just if you could imagine that for a second, wow. What an incredible transformational opportunity that would be for the country. Someone who has very clear views on the issues, is an organizer who can bring people to activism and mobilize them to push the Senate for change. She'd be one out of 100 voices, which would be incredible power. She would the Senate rules give a lot of power to single voices, you know, to stop legislation, to push forward legislation. She could be holding, doing all sorts of town meetings around the state and the country. She would be a national figure immediately that would begin a transformational process. So it's an uphill struggle. Because, you know, we're going against Chris Van Hollen, who was the former DCCC chairman, who that basically is the fundraiser for the Congress. So he was like the bag man for Wall Street and big business when he was doing that. Or Donna Edwards, who would not have a campaign if it had not been for a super PAC that's giving millions of dollars. So we're going against, you know, traditional big money corruption. And so Margaret has a tough fight ahead. And I hope people go to flowersforsenate.org and contribute, because that's the kind of fight we have. But if she were to make it into the Senate, it would be a transformational moment for this country to have someone in the Senate who was a Green, and with her history as one of the founders of the occupation in Freedom Plaza in 2011, on up to being a leading single-payer activist, a fair trade advocate. There's so much that she would be doing that would be so significant, which is why I suspect they want to keep her out and don't want people to hear her voice or know what she stands for, because it would be a real transformational moment for the country.
Kevin Zeese, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me on.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.